From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking tiny birds on today's show. We'll meet a little winged creature called the red knot in a moment. And then we say hello to a group of people unenviably known as harbingers of failure. That's coming up. First, though, did you watch the season premiere of Game of Thrones on Sunday night? GPB Savannah's Emily Jones did, and she had some harsh critiques for how the show and other fantasy authors treat the female characters.
When you're willing to throw modern medicine and technology and even physics to the wind, why, of all things, do you have to cling to the gender norms of our real world? Winter can last years and dead bodies can return as creepy ice zombies, but somehow women are still primarily expected to be dutiful wives and mothers. What?
So we wanted to know, what do you think about the way women are portrayed in science fiction and in fantasy? Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Verna. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm talking about the role of the women in the fairy tale shows. I totally agree with what you guys said before, but if you pay attention at the ABC Once Upon a Time show, all the princesses are badass princesses, and actually the weak ones are the boys. So I just wanted to highlight that one. All right.
Nice. We always love to get your suggestions. You can call us at 404-500-9457 like Verna did, or you can tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The Ottumwa River is not one of Georgia's more popular natural landmarks. It's not a destination like Stone Mountain or Lake Lanier, but this little-known water source, it's not little at all in physicality, but it's huge. However, little known, plays a vital role for several species of shorebirds during their annual migration. One of those birds is the red knot. These tiny birds travel more than 19,000 miles during migration, and they use Georgia's coast as a safe haven along the way. Author Deborah Kramer chronicled the red knot's journey in her latest book. It's called The Narrow Edge, and she joins us now to talk about her work. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Celeste.
And I saw that you also won the 2016 Reed Environmental Writing Award from the Southern Environmental Law Center. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much. It was quite an honor.
So I wanted to ask you about this narrow edge. The name of the book is Narrow Edge. What edge are you referring to?
I'm referring to that liminal porous place at the edge of the sea where the tide comes in and out. It's neither land nor water, or I guess you'd say it's both, and it's constantly changing.
And it also feels, certainly by the time you get to the end of the book, that the narrow edge is also our almost a window of opportunity that we have at this moment to either act on climate change or not. Did you sense that narrow edge as you were writing?
Well, yes, it is. It's an incredible opportunity for us, actually, because the water is rising and there is lots of wildlife living along the edge of the sea, but so are we. And in protecting their homes, we'll also be protecting ourselves.
Well, let's go to this tiny bird. The subtitle of your book is A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. And the tiny bird that you're talking about is the red knot. Let's first hear from the red knot. Here's the sound of one. What makes this bird special?
Well, to me, this bird is really special because it weighs no more than a coffee mug, and yet something that small manages to fly 19,000 miles every year from the very bottom of South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle and back.
And again, you said the very bottom of South America. I want people to picture that in their minds because this journey is unbelievable when you look at it on the map. They start, many of them start in Tierra del Fuego, right? The very southern tip of South America, and travel up through Canada to the Arctic where they breed. Is that right?
That's right. And the place on Tierra del Fuego is a really remote beach. It's just mile after mile of unbroken sand along the Strait of Magellan. And the tides are treacherous there, and the winds are treacherous there. They're often blowing at hurricane strength, and the birds are there for 4 or 5 months.
But the reason that I'm talking to you, and I assume the reason that you'll be speaking at the Atlanta Audubon Bird Festival this weekend, is because of the very important stop that they make in Georgia at the Ottumwa River. And that's where they encounter the horseshoe crab, which is the ancient crab of your title. Why is the horseshoe crab so important?
The horseshoe crab is so important to the red knot because its tiny pin-sized eggs constitute the fuel that'll take this bird all the way up to the Arctic. So a red knot needs to eat about 400,000 of those horseshoe crab eggs in order to gain enough weight to make the flight all the way up to the tundra and then have a few resources left over in case the snow hasn't started to melt and there's nothing to eat.
Is Georgia a kind of halfway point?
Georgia is a really important stop on this. I would say it's probably a little more than halfway, but it for many of these birds, it's the last stop before they go up to the Arctic. So it's really important that they get enough food in Georgia. It's also true that the Ottumwa River is a very important stop for them coming south as well.
So then what happens, and I'm not the expert, you are, so please correct me.
Not necessarily.
But I understand that part of the reason climate change is affecting these birds so much, and there's a Tufts University study that showed that almost 90% of North American shorebirds are at increased risk now. But one of the things is that when these eggs that you're talking about, they can hatch too early because of the warm temperature. Is that part of what affects the red knot?
Well, they can. One of the things that the Fish and Wildlife Service is concerned about is that as the water warms, the horseshoe crabs might come into spawn earlier and the eggs might be there and the birds might not have arrived. So they are concerned that that is a problem. What is interesting to me about that, though, is that these birds have an uncanny ability to find food within hours of its becoming available. So horseshoe crabs have just started spawning in big numbers in Georgia, and the birds will just miraculously appear on the beach where they've been spawning. So the last time I was on Little St. Simons, for example, there hadn't been any red knots seen yet. There hadn't been any horseshoe crabs. And then at night, the horseshoe crabs came in. And then the next morning, I went down to this inlet that I'd been going to every morning, and there were 1,000 red knots there eating the horseshoe crabs.
And Little St. Simons Island, for those who don't recognize it, is a little island. It's mostly an eco resort here in Georgia. So I read another naturalist and author, Joel Greenberg, said perhaps the red knot should replace the canary in the mine as the harbinger of impending changes that are good neither for birds or people. I wonder what you make of that, this idea that the red knot could be our canary in the mine.
Well, he did say that about the narrow edge, and I think I would tend to agree with him because the story of the red knot is really the story of 50 million other shorebirds coming through North America, many of which aren't quite as well known, maybe, as the red knot, although I'm discovering a lot of people don't know about the red knot either.
Or know when they're looking at one.
Right. Well, it's hard to recognize. It was even hard for me to recognize when I first started. But then once you get to see it, it's a beautiful, beautiful bird. And so I would agree with him. There are lots of other shorebirds that eat horseshoe crab eggs. There are lots of other shorebirds that live at the edge of the sea where the water is rising. And there are lots of other shorebirds that are nesting up in the Arctic, a place which is changing rapidly.
So we got this tweet from the Georgia Ornithological Society, the GOS president, and they say an easy way to help shorebirds is stop flushing them on the beach, walk around them, they need the rest. And I mean, you followed this bird all over the place. Did you see people disturbing birds as they rested on the beach?
Well, I think almost everybody does that, and they don't realize what they're doing. And even I was guilty of that. I used to walk along the beach up in Massachusetts where I lived, and I would walk along the beach, and I would love approaching a group of birds and then watching them lift up into the sky. I think actually lots of people do that, and it had never occurred to me, and I don't mean to sound stupid about this, but it had never occurred to me as I watched these beautiful flocks of birds rising and falling with the waves that that was actually taking energy from them that they needed to make these long distance flights. So I would agree with the Georgia Ornithological Society that when you're walking on a beach, if you see a flock of birds at the edge of the water, it'd be great to take a detour around them.
And keep your dog away from them, too, because my dog will disturb them just for the fun of it. So, I mean, again, do you have any idea how many miles you actually traversed while you were following this bird for this book?
Well, that was another thing. The birds go from this round trip from the bottom of South America up to the Arctic and back, and that's about 19,000 miles. And I went from the bottom of South America up to the Arctic and then back to my home in Massachusetts. And in order for me to do that, I logged in 44,000 miles. And then if you counted the translators who came with me, it was 66,000 miles just to follow this tiny bird.
I guess that's why they say as the crow flies, meaning a straight line. In this case, as the red knot flies. So what do you take away? I mean, your book describes, I mean, it sounds like you came away with a real love for this bird and a respect. But I wonder what you take away from the red knot as a harbinger of what may come and the narrow edge that we're sort of balancing on right now.
Well, I came away with a couple of things. I felt like we're facing some serious problems. But when I look at this bird and what it does to make this enormous trip under increasingly difficult circumstances, it's still making the trip. And I look at what the bird is able to do and I think, you know, we can do what we need to do also to give the bird safe passage. And I've seen people along this entire flyway on really, really crowded beaches in Argentina. I've seen people in Georgia. I've seen people in Delaware Bay. I've seen people in the Arctic working really, really hard by doing some of the things that you've suggested, making it possible for the birds to rest freely on the beach, asking people to stay off the beaches when the birds are, for the few weeks the birds are there, suggesting that there be not so much development right along the edge of the shore, regulating the take of horseshoe crabs so that the birds will have enough eggs to eat. All those things can really help bring this bird back from the edge of extinction. And the population has now been stabilized, and I think that it will be possible to do the rest of what we need to do. I think of this migration, actually, as a ladder going up to the Arctic, where now every rung is necessary, and some of the rungs are broken. Yeah. But if we fix them rung by rung, they'll be able to make the flights.
That's Deborah Kramer, author of The Narrow Edge. She'll be a featured speaker at the Atlanta Audubon Bird Festival this Sunday. You can get more information at gpbnews.org. Deborah, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Just ahead, what it's like to have the grades and desire to go to college but be held back by immigration status. This is On Second Thought. Atlanta almost celebrated an historic event last November. A massive Nobel Peace Summit was planned in the city. The event would have included heads of state and Nobel laureates like President Obama, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and activist Malala Yousafzai. But after millions of dollars raised, plans for the summit fell through. 11 Alive reporter Katie Beck has followed the story, and she joins me on the line. Hi there.
Hi.
First of all, why didn't the event, it was eventually moved to Spain, but why didn't it happen in Atlanta?
Well, I think there was a number of reasons why it fell apart, but I think ultimately the reason that it was relocated was because the city of Atlanta withdrew its support for the event. Kasim Reed was struggling to feel as though he had a full view of how the funds were being raised, and he had asked for further layers of transparency. The event organizer, Dr. Mohammed Bayan, did not wish to go that route. So the two of them sort of ended up in a standoff, and that's where things really unraveled.
And that relationship is still contentious at this point.
Yes, it certainly is. I think the mayor is still wanting to be repaid for the money that was put up by the city of Atlanta for the event, and that has not yet happened.
So do we have a total of how I know there have been a lot of claims of lack of transparency, but do we have a confirmed total of the amount of money raised?
Very little is confirmed because of the fact that no spreadsheets or accounting documents have ever really been produced. I've asked for them several times. I know that the mayor had asked for them during the process. We still have not actually seen an accounting statement from a bank, but according to Dr. Mohammed Bayan, about $1.3 million was the total amount that was raised for the event.
How did you get onto this story? Did you hear from donors themselves?
I did. Donors contacted me because they said it had been a substantial period of time had passed. For some people, it had been 2 years that they had donated a substantial money towards this event and had hoped it would be a big success. And then when it fell through, assumed that at some point they would be reimbursed. So they called me and asked me to investigate where the funds were and why they hadn't seen them returned yet.
And you actually had access to a letter that was received by a donor. What did that letter say?
Yes. Within the past few weeks, donors have received a letter, donors that attended a gala early on for this event, basically were told that they were being offered a partial reimbursement. $101 was the amount for attending this gala. Now, the tickets to it were $500, so it is a partial refund, but that if they would sign on the line, accept the money, and no claims afterwards, then they would be reimbursed that amount.
So they got a letter that you had access to, so no idea how many donors this went out to, but it was offering them 1/20th of what they spent on the gala if they promised they were not going to pursue it any further.
Correct. Yes.
And we don't know how much the gala actually cost?
Those numbers, again, they're based on what Dr. Bayan is saying, that he believes it was, you know, there was expenses in terms of renting the venue space and obviously putting the gala on. So that is why he's returning the money on sort of a pro rata basis, because he says there were expenses incurred, and that's what that money is covering.
What kind of oversight is there for, I mean, obviously, if there's an organization that's organizing an event, then they have oversight either within the organization or whomever oversees that organization. But what kind of oversight was there for this particular event?
I think that's a good question. I think, and that was part of, Mayor Kasim Reed was feeling like there wasn't enough oversight. That was his contention, that there needed to be a more centralized accounting of what was happening. Now, the Atlanta Rotary Club was involved, and some very prominent people, as you stated, Jason Carter, Laura Turner Seidel, lots of good-minded people that really wanted this to work. But there didn't seem to be, enough sharing of information, enough transparency, and I think that's sort of where things broke down.
What about the corporate sponsors? What's happened with their agreements?
Well, the corporate sponsors have also received pro rata reimbursements, if you will. The Fulbright Association actually filed a lawsuit and settled that lawsuit to get part of their money back. The others have received partial amounts as well. Those numbers are part of settlement agreements, so no one's saying exactly how much they got back. But all of the sponsors, with the exception of the city of Atlanta, have been reimbursed. The mayor, Kasim Reed, has said that he's not willing to accept the settlement amount that's being offered. So right now, they're sort of in a stalemate on that.
How much did the city spend?
$25,000. It actually came from the airport fund, but it's still city funds. So it's about $25,000.
So do we know if any of the funds that were raised for Atlanta actually ended up being used in Barcelona, Spain?
I don't believe that they were. The summit was moved to Barcelona, and that it was a completely separate process there to raise money.
So what questions do you have? If you were given unlimited access to the books, such as they are, what do you still need to have answered?
Well, you know, as an investigative journalist, I'm skeptical of anything that I can't verify. So I'd love to be able to take everyone's word when they tell me something, but I prefer to see numbers. And I still to this day would like to see exactly how much money went into that fund, exactly how much money went out of that fund, what the expenses were, how many donors gave money, how many donors are getting money back. And, you know, I think all of that information is pretty vague right now.
And what have you heard from the donors that contacted you? Are they satisfied with what they've heard so far? Or are they still upset?
No, I don't think they're satisfied. I think they're going to accept the offer for some of the money to be returned, because at this point they're skeptical that they're going to get anything back. But I do think most of them will sign and take the reimbursement as it is. I think, you know, they're obviously not thrilled about the fact that they spent much more than that initially. And I think it's a real sad story for Atlanta, because this was going to be a world-class event and could have really put the city on a center stage that, you know, would have brought so much good attention. And as you said, you know, former presidents come, the current president was planning to come, you know, celebrities. It brings a lot of, you know, good publicity to Atlanta, and all of that was sort of washed away.
What are the next steps? I know you mentioned that the mayor's office is still negotiating to see how much of their $25,000 they'll get back, but it sounds like a lot of these other things are sort of private agreements and settlements. Will it ever move into a more official capacity in terms of an investigation?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think that the mayor is certainly is trying to recoup the full amount. I don't think that that he's willing to take anything less than that. That's my intuition speaking there. But I think that he feels very strongly that the city should be reimbursed fully. As far as an investigation, you know, I don't think that there will be, frankly. I think this will probably just continue to be sort of a sad story and kind of a black eye for the city, and that donors will have to probably take their losses.
From what you have heard from donors, I imagine that's frustrating, and I wonder if that's true, because basically they're being told to trust someone that 4/5 of their money for those who went to the gala was used in a credible capacity, and they have to take that statement on faith.
Yeah, and I think it hurts fundraising in the future in our city, because people feel that when they give that money, it's for a certain purpose, and that they expect that purpose to come to fruition. They never expected that they were going to be donating towards a cause that was going to fall apart. I think that most of them had a lot of faith in this event, and they had they're humanitarians, they're advocates, they're community organizers, they're people that really advocate for peace and justice and want to see good things happen. So I think they had good intentions, and I think it really does sort of scar people from giving again when they've been misled.
But is this as far as you can take the investigation, Katie?
No, it's not. fortunately, I will keep asking questions, and I will. The one piece that's so largely unresolved is that tax money that was given from the city of Atlanta, from the airport, from the mayor, and see how that resolves. When I spoke to Mayor Reed about this, he said that they had obviously considered taking legal action, but would the cost of pursuing that outweigh the amount that they would get back in return? That's sort of what they're trying to decide. Would it be, a good decision to move forward with a lawsuit if they're not going to make their money back? So I think he's probably weighing those options now, but we plan to stay on it.
Katie Beck is a reporter for 11 Alive News. Katie, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Let's add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. Today we'll hear from Baroness lead singer John Dyer Baisley. We asked him to pick two songs that best represent the Peach State. The songs have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians are not allowed to nominate their own work. So let's keep the ultimate essential Georgia playlist going.
My name is John Baisley. I'm the singer and guitar player in Baroness. The first song I chose for my Georgia playlist is Descend Within by Kailessa. It's one of the tracks on the second side of their first LP. It is a song that is essentially built around this very simple, very hypnotic drum beat. In my mind, it's kind of like it's a very slight variation on the drum beat to Snowblind from Black Sabbath, but it's played a little slower and the pocket is a little bit more laid back. There was something about it that just sunk in and really just had everybody in a room immediately synchronized with one another. This was extreme, but in a very different direction. It wasn't complicated. In fact, it was very simple. It was about textures and sounds and rhythm. It struck me as odd that I just hadn't seen that before, and that maybe it was going on, but I was unaware of it, or I had the sense that there just was something going on that I didn't understand yet, and I really wanted to be a part of that. I remember seeing them play this song, and it was the first time in years that I had seen something that felt fresh and that felt creative and that felt different, that spoke to me and touched me in the way that only those specific songs do at those specific times and those specific places, you know, those really defining fork in the road moments musically. I mean, it was so loud and it was so heavy, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't predictable. It wasn't like loud and heavy and angry. It, you know, it seemed like there was more poetry there, and it seemed like there was more artistry going on. The second song on my Georgia playlist is Two-Headed Boy by Neutral Milk Hotel. Two-headed was something in Neutral Milk Hotel that struck a chord with me, which was the idea of working in a style or genre that is familiar but somehow feels incredibly fresh and incredibly innovative. At the point that I discovered them, they were different, you know, for a variety of reasons. First of all, it wasn't entirely guitar-based music, which is essentially what Baroness is. It also was very melodic vocally. I'm not really sure what exactly you would call them. I think nowadays they would probably just call it indie rock or something like that. But, you know, there were horns, there were strings, there were acoustic guitars, there was distortion at times, there was, you know, layered vocals, and there was all sorts of sounds kind of swirling in and swirling out. And it had this lo-fi kind of quality to it. It sounded like a collection of first takes. Your eyes ain't moving now. They just lay there in there. The thing that struck me the most was the abstraction of his lyrics, yet the way that they seemed to resonate in a way that was understandable. Sometimes you can listen to something and the composition of words makes no sense when you say it, But as soon as you put a melody to it, and as soon as you orchestrate around it, the words take on this really florid, you know, and sort of beauty that doesn't require that you understand the literal narrative.
It's lava who's floating and choking with her hands across her face. And in the dark we will take off our clothes and they'll be placing fingers through the notches in your spine. And
if you can imagine it, you should at least be able to give it a, you know, give it a go. And, you know, I learned that, I think, through Neutral Milk Hotel and bands like that, but they were the most obvious example of that. And they happened to be a Georgia band, so here we are talking about them.
John Baisley is the lead singer for Baroness. They'll play the Shaky Knees Festival in Atlanta this weekend. Do you have a song you want to add to the Georgia playlist? You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. Sing a little while you're at it. You know, some of the biggest, most successful companies have been responsible for some of the biggest flops in product history. There was McDonald's Arch Deluxe, introduced in 1996. It was a burger targeted to adults with more sophisticated palates.
The best ingredients are just the start of a great burger. Crisp leaves of iceberg lettuce. The stone-ground mustard sauce. Mmm. The soft, comforting potato roll. I'm in the zone. All layered together in one symphony of taste.
The Arch Deluxe did not last long. Car enthusiasts may remember Ford's Edsel, known as the Titanic of automobiles.
Driving the 1958 Edsel is as easy as flicking a light switch. For Edsel's exclusive new Teletouch Drive shifts electrically at a touch. It's a new idea that puts shifting where it belongs, so you can keep both hands safely at the wheel.
Only 64,000 of those cars were sold in the first year, and Ford lost $250 million. And of course, let's not forget one of the most notorious corporate blunders, New Coke.
A slam, a shout, it's a new way to see. It'll shake up the world, it's the way it should be. It's just how you feel when you know it's for real. It's a kick, it's a hit, it's a Coke. Coke is it.
But somebody did buy those products, maybe regrettably. A study suggests these people may be the kind of consumers who can help predict which products will fail by liking them. Catherine Tucker worked on that study. She's a marketing professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and we spoke with Catherine last year. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
And what a really painful word for this group of people, harbingers of failure.
Yes. Yes, well, I must admit, I like that term.
You do?
I do like that term because I think it really signals the extent to which they signal doom for any product development process. We wanted that aura of doom with our naming of them.
Okay. Explain to me how this works. These are people who, they have to be early adopters. They get in early, right?
That's right.
And they really like something, and then it fails.
That's right. So who they are is, we look at all people who adopt new products, and then we identify the people who, as a proportion of the new products they buy, tend to buy flop. And what we do is we then look at those group of people and see how they behave in the future. And we find that they keep on buying flops. So it's just not just that they buy new products, but they, when they buy new products, they buy the ones that flop consistently. And also what's remarkable about them is that their bad taste isn't just confined to one category. It's just not that they keep on buying bad toothpaste. But we see them buying toothpaste that flops, and then we see them buying laundry detergent that flops, and then we see them buying sodas that flop.
I'm laughing, but this is terrible. We actually, okay, so Catherine, we went out into the streets of Atlanta and spoke with some people and asked them about some products they really liked that were discontinued. So take a listen here.
Oh, Hi-C Ecto Cooler. Do you remember that? That was great. You felt, I don't know, it was kind of like a cool kid thing to have. Ecto Cooler with your Dunkaroos, I guess, at lunch.
One product I miss is the Carnation breakfast bars. I think it was the original energy bar. It wasn't as sweet as and sugary as a lot of the energy bars are now. You know, it would help me keep from eating candy, and it was more nutritious than candy.
Sprite Remix was very great. It was very good, even though I don't really drink sodas anymore, but back then I just liked Sprite Remix because, you know, you had the fruit punch kind of orange thing in it. They brought the LeBron type of Sprite out, but it's not the same as the Sprite Remix.
It seems like the products that I enjoy the most are always being discontinued. There was a chicken sauce flavor at KFC years and years ago that I loved. I couldn't go like a week without stopping by and having some. My best memory of the sauce was just going to KFC to eat it with my husband, because at the time we were newlyweds, and so it was just one of the things that we would go and do together.
Now, all these people mentioned, Catherine, food, but from your description, it sounds like it's not just food that these people like and it ends up being a total failure.
No. I mean, what I want you to see is that last lady who had the beautiful memories of, as a newlywed, eating the chicken sauce at KFC, she said at the beginning, all the products I like are taken from the shelves. So we always remember, you know, food, because it's particularly memorable when we like food that other people don't. If you identify a lady like that, she is a good predictor about whether your new mop product or your new laundry detergent product will fail.
So she's actually valuable. That lady, Rochelle, is actually valuable to marketers.
She is incredibly valuable, because one thing I want you to notice, and this is one thing we found in the research which really helps you identify these people, is she said not just she liked this KFC sauce that no one else liked, but that once she tried it, she just kept on going back and back and back and back. And one of the strongest signals you are one of these harbingers of failure is that after you taste a product which everyone else thinks is terrible, you keep on going back and back and back and buy more and more and more. That pretty much suggests you're very valuable to marketers in terms of predicting flops.
Why had we not looked at this from this angle before? I mean, we often, marketers, do tons and tons of research into what people like. How come we're only now hearing about the, I hate using this phrase, it sounds so mean, but these harbingers of failure, these kiss of death people?
So one thing I found about marketing is we tend to be very positive people. And we tend to constantly focus on the idea of identifying who likes our products. And we use that to try and identify, well, who should we target and who's the right population for our group. So anytime we get data on people, which is negative, which is about failure, which uses these words that make you uncomfortable, like harbinger of failure, then we tend to reject that or push that aside because we don't tend to think that is what marketing is about. So I think what's new about this research is saying actually looking at systematic patterns of failure can be as important as trying to understand systematic patterns of success.
Well, let's go back to the people that we spoke to here in Atlanta, because none of them, many of them admitted that they liked products that ended up failing, but none of them wanted that title. Take a listen.
No, I'm not a harbinger of failure because I don't like to fail, period. Thing about it is, things fail for a reason. Just different things, just whatever the demographic wants, what the demographic needs, whatever the consumer wants.
I don't think I'm a harbinger of failure. Every product I've liked has flourished, so I think I'm doing fine.
It's possible. Because I have eclectic taste and sometimes I like things that are a little bit out of the ordinary and not necessarily mainstream items.
No, I'm not. Okay. Even though I am. Yeah.
I don't know if I would call myself. I feel like that happens to me. But I don't know if I would call myself or be a member of that group per se. I didn't know that was a group that people identified with in general.
That's a sad group. I feel sorry for them.
Lonely Hearts Club.
So, and it does seem kind of depressing that you were talking about a group of people who will never get to keep what they like.
So I think that's a wonderful set of reactions. And I'll just tell you what I've heard too. I totally understand that in some ways we've codified or given a name to this this feeling of continued depression that all the products you like are pulled from the shelves, which I think is a part of the negative reaction. In some sense, people also respond, I never knew that there were other people like me. I always thought it was just me who had these products pulled from the shelves that I liked, and I didn't realize that there was actually other people to whom this happened as well. So I agree people might not love the term or be being told that they are a harbinger of failure, but I think people are at least somewhat receptive to the idea that they are not alone and that there is some kind of explanation for what they've observed happening in their life before.
So what this sounds like to me, Catherine, is that after they go through that whole battery of tests and you're finally ready to, as you say, put them out on the shelves, they need one more test, which is to identify a group of people who are the kiss of death, present this product to them, and if these people enjoy it, stop the presses. Stop. Do not produce that product. Is that your advice?
That is certainly partly my advice. So at least I'd say set your expectations that this is going to be a niche product and should therefore not maybe be rolled out to Target and Walmart, but maybe just make it available on the internet or something like that. It's certainly not a product you want to try and invest in to make it a mainstream product because it never will.
I guess in our day and age where you can go on the internet through eBay or Pinterest or any of the other sites and kind of find everything you want, that if it is a niche product, maybe there's hope for someone who is a harbinger of failure. Maybe they will be able to find the things that they like as long as the person, their business model is focused around only selling to a small number of them.
I think that's right. I mean, remember, our research was focused on the question of retail assortment. And in a retail assortment, you only really want to have products which have a chance of being mainstream, especially if you have limited store space. The wonderful thing about the internet, and maybe this is the hopeful or positive news for someone who's listened to this segment and thought, oh my gosh, I am a harbinger of failure, is that at least we have the internet now, which allows us to cater somewhat to more niche tastes.
And before, we only have about a minute or so left, but is there a chance that based on the research that you've done and the research that's coming, that companies will be able to use people like this to figure out what products will fail? I mean, is that how reliable this group is?
So let me tell you where it's going with companies. So first of all, without doubt, this is incredibly reliable as a prediction methodology. We have spent 3 years trying to make this result go away. It definitely isn't a statistical artifact. I think the question for us is we can easily identify these people in retail data, and that is when the products hit the shelves. What we haven't done yet, and that's where we maybe need to figure this out, is how to use them in the pre-test, pre-product launch stage.
Are you a harbinger of failure, Catherine?
I am afraid so. I am like every one of those people you interviewed. This is a personal paper for me.
Can you name a product that you liked that disappeared?
I loved Crystal Pepsi.
Oh, no one loved Crystal Pepsi. Oh, boy. Okay.
I thought it was such a clever idea. Transparent Coke.
Okay, MIT marketing professor Catherine Tucker, self-described kiss of death. Catherine, it's really good to talk to you.
It was lovely to talk to you too. Thank you very much.
A new poll conducted by WSB-TV in Atlanta shows Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump in a statistical dead heat in Georgia. Immigration is a major issue in that race, and it's a personal one for a lot of Georgians. Valentina Amelia Garcia Gonzalez is 20 years old and undocumented. She grew up just outside of Atlanta. Gonzalez says she struggled with college admissions and scholarships here in Georgia because of her immigration status. For help, she turned to Freedom University. It's an informal school in Georgia for undocumented youth. Gonzalez offers this commentary.
I was born on February 16th, 1996, in Uruguay. I grew up dancing and laughing and being completely oblivious to my family's struggles. My father had built the home I grew up in from scratch, and it took him 11 years. He worked two jobs, maybe three, in order to keep my family fed, clothed, and as healthy as we could possibly be. But things were different in Atlanta. When registering me for elementary school, my mother couldn't speak any English, and at the time, neither did I. The lady at the front wanted to register me as white, though I was not. She is pale and can pass off as white. When she learns English, she'll be fine, she told my mother in Spanish. To be assigned a race because it was convenient was something my mother fought tooth and nail, but to no avail. Up until my senior year in high school, I was still considered white. But once I hit high school, my documentation status was slapped in my face wherever I went. I was an excellent student, but I soon found out that I couldn't go to college because of changes the Georgia Board of Regents made in 2011. As an undocumented student, I can no longer apply to the top five public universities in the state or receive in-state tuition at any of the state's other public universities. No UGA, no Georgia Tech, Georgia State, GCSU, or Georgia Southern. I didn't know what to do. As my close friends were putting in their applications, I had to sit by and think of ways to actually get myself into college. And these were the same friends that I had grown up with. They cheated off of my test and shared my lunches. But I ultimately learned about Freedom University, which helped me navigate the college application process. The program offers financial aid assistance, leadership development classes, and college-level classes for undocumented students in Georgia. But even more, it gave me the confidence to openly demand justice and debate policies that ban undocumented students. There are many students like me that don't know about their resources and their opportunities to achieve a higher education. What is most disappointing is that Georgia, even after 5 years, remains adamant about maintaining discriminatory and segregationist bans that ultimately cause a brain drain in the state. So highly qualified students who happen to be undocumented have to jump through hurdles and hoops to attend college in Georgia when it should not be the case. Georgia needs to lift the bans and let undocumented students show their amazing talents that get overlooked due to their immigration status.
Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez of Kennesaw, Georgia, is in her first year at Dartmouth College. She's a microbiology major on the pre-med track.